one of these topics we're going to talk about today could easily fill an hour plus conversation. This is just designed to give you like a map, and not to drive you to the places, not to tell you the landmarks, not to help you along the way, just to give you the map and say, here you go, figure it out yourself, kid. As an example, I talked to Brittany's team for 30 minutes about one of the items and one of the topics on this presentation today. So just try to absorb it in. There's a couple takeaways, but it's very high level, and just to get you guys thinking about what you might want to do going forward. In kindergarten, we learned about, you know, the five W's about any situation, so we'll dig into that right away. I'm sure most everyone in this room is already aware of these things, but the what? So ransomware is what we're talking about today. It's malicious software that makes a system unusable. It encrypts the hard drives and stops the systems from functioning, and generally speaking, wrecks the data on the system. When these attacks take a while to infect a machine, it's not instantaneous. You know that a process has to be running to do the encryption. So oftentimes, attackers choose holiday weekends to kick these things off. Hence, have boring weekends, enjoy your Christmases, enjoy your New Year's, enjoy your Labor Days, things like that. And that's the impetus for the presentation title. It'd probably be quicker to say where isn't being attacked by ransomware these days. Business, healthcare, education, small cities, big cities, anywhere that you can come up with has probably been hit by ransomware. Why? Well, this was an easy one. Money. Last year, businesses announced that they'd paid $350 million in ransomware payments, which, I don't know about you guys. When I make mistakes, I go out to Twitter and say, hey, I really screwed up, and this is what it cost me. That's the first thing I do. So I imagine everyone else does that, too, with their mistakes. They like to publicize them and make sure that everybody knows. So if business is like the rest of us, I imagine $350 million is on the very, very low end of the actual cost. The other thing about that is it gives you bad publicity. For example, I'm sure everyone in this room knew that there's a giant pipeline in the South called the Colonial Pipeline. Everybody knows that, right? That's just like, common knowledge. I didn't know that until this year when they got hit with a $4 million ransomware. And I'm sure everyone knows that they're the largest beef supplier in the world, JBS. Everybody knows that too, right? That's just like trivia knowledge. Yeah, $11 million that they paid out in ransomware this year. So I learned both those were companies and that they were attacked by ransomware. And it's been a slow week. It's Labor Day weekend, but just this week, Howard University had to shut down all of their classes because they got hit with ransomware. The how. Well, this is complicated, but big picture, credential reuse is one of the big issues. Phishing emails, and systems that are not as secure as we believe them to be. And last but not least, why not just pay, right? I mean, I'm sure everybody's got $4 to $11 million just sitting around in their couch cushions. The other thing to know about this is that oftentimes, if a company pays, the attackers will hit them again. Because, if you paid once, you're probably going to pay again, and chances are you're not going to fix your systems in the meantime. So, from a very high level again, this is not a thing we see in computers. Technology is very complicated and hard, and for the most part, you just power it up and it works until it doesn't, which is a problem. Is it slow? Maybe, I don't know. And so that becomes a problem too. Computers and technology has become much more binary. It either works or it doesn't. It doesn't, misfire. It doesn't start blowing black smoke out of the engine. It doesn't, it doesn't blow a fuse. It just either works or it doesn't. And by the time it doesn't, it's generally too late. So, this is a very hard thing to tackle. So I just want to try to level set and, get an idea of the actual problem we're working on. So I'll let you guys read this one, and I'll take a drink of water here. But Ben Franklin, back in the 1800s, said an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In all of these cases, I mean, 200 years later, it's still true. I'm sure that Colonial Pipeline would have rather paid, you know, $500,000 worth of employee costs for 8 years versus one ransomware payment. So, and obviously they had the money, they just weren't doing it. So, you know, think about that as you're working on this stuff. But those are the topics we're gonna talk about this afternoon. If you only took one thing away from this presentation, this is what I would like you to try to work on. And this is the elephant in the room, credential management. The overwhelming majority, four-fifths roughly, of all attacks of any type are due to password reuse. So if you use a different password everywhere you have a login, you are in the tiny minority of the threat vectors. You know, year after year, this is always the number one thing. And the reason is for twofold. Number one, humans are really bad with passwords. So it's really easy. So those are the two reasons. This is easy to do, and humans are horrible at it. So, you know, start using LastPass, Bitwarden, Dashlane, whatever you'd like. But start using a different username and password for every site you can as often as possible, and then you'll be in the, you know, then they have to want to try to get you, and you have to usually make a mistake as opposed to just having, you know, being a regular human, and then you'll get hit. So outside of credential management, another way to minimize these kinds of things is to divide and survive, as opposed to divide and conquer, which is what attackers want to do. So from a very high level, divide your networks, divide your firewalls, and divide your accounts. The first one, divide your accounts. So this is, the technical term is called credential tiering. It's, there's a lot of words up there, but big picture, do not use an account over and over and over again. So does this laser pointer work? Maybe, nope. On the very first, the lowest level is tier two. So that is regular user land. So do not use the same account on a middle tier, where that would be like your servers, your databases, that kind of thing. And then use even a different account for your key servers. So your domain administrators, things like that. Have each account be different, because in the current and common usage of accounts, you have one account across all three of those systems, and then if the account gets compromised in one location, then it's trivial to jump to the other ones. And we see this happening over and over again. People use, you know, an admin, a privileged user uses the same username and password throughout their system, and then it gets leaked, and then the next thing you know, they're having a very bad weekend. And this also works for SaaS, which is software as a service, so any kind of cloud application you use. So you could have an administrator account to administer the service, and then a user account to use the service. Getting back to my earlier example of LastPass, at the university we have LastPass administrator accounts that we only use to administer the service. I don't use it on a day-to-day basis. This is for twofold, really. Number one, it's because it is the best security practice. But for number two, it also prevents me from just twiddling the knobs when I'm bored every now and then. Not that I'm bored anymore, but if I was, then I can't just make changes. I have to intentionally do something to tweak the configuration. And again, this is a colleague of mine gave a whole hour presentation on this topic, and I'm giving you guys about 2 minutes. So, but this is a great thing to do and will really pay dividends quickly. The next idea is network segmentation. So basically, you know, keep the different bits from talking to each other unless they have to. And if they do have to talk to each other, make sure that you know about it and it's intentional. All of these things, this is defense in depth 101. This works, again, because you keep if something happens, you contain that attack to just the region where it gets in. So for example, let's say one of your users clicks on a phishing email, and you've got that user workstation locked down from the rest of the system, then it stays there, and just your user workstations are impacted. And hopefully those are basically throwaway anyway, and you can wipe them and get them back going again. And you've got a couple hours of work, as opposed to if you infected the whole system, days or possibly even weeks of work. Another example of this that is becoming more and more common is to try to segment different pieces of equipment together. So for example, if you have a printers, like put all those printers on one network and then control the inputs and outputs to those systems, because realistically you're not going to be printing from your domain controller. Like if you're using your domain controller as a printer, don't do that. Just tell me you're not, but if you are, stop it and then lock that down, because those two things should never be happening. You should print from user land, not from server land. Another example would be any IoT things. So if you've got I don't know what you guys have, but like at home, Nest Thermostat is on its own little network, so it can't talk to my printers, it can't talk to my computers, it just does what it needs to do all by itself. And if something happens to it, it can't infect anything else. That's, again, basic idea of this. Last but not least in this one, if it has a firewall, turn it on. Just make sure that if something does get compromised, it will be harder for it to infect other things. Because realistically, if you are hit with ransomware, the best thing you want to have happen is to have one machine get knocked down, and hopefully it's just a user machine that has nothing of value on it. Usually what happens that we see is a user machine gets infected, that machine has lots of accounts on it because it has domain accounts on it, you know, it's not segmented off, and the next thing you know, the whole network is infected. So if you firewall that off, then that machine can't talk to everything else, and that machine is less likely to infect the other machines in its network zone. I'm really operating system agnostic. It's a tool, it does a job. I don't have a favorite hammer, I don't have a favorite ruler, they're just tools. But we see over and over again that Windows is the common vector because it is the most prevalent operating system in business use. So a good starting question would be, does this actually need to be Windows? So if you can, you know, just ask that. There are a lot of options out there. I'm not going to read all these to you, but those are all alternatives. Many of them do much the same things. And if you actually look at, you know, so this user needs to have a web browser, have an email client, and work on Word documents, many of these things would serve that purpose, and it would limit the damage if that user gets infected. So that's really a great starting question. And oftentimes, as a bonus, the other options are cheaper. One thing I do want to point out, the cloud desktop, or VDI, which is virtual desktop infrastructure, is a really, is a really neat idea. So basically these are, every computer is a virtual machine, and you can just wipe that and start over again. Does everybody know what a virtual machine is? I'm gonna guess in this room, yes? Yeah, okay, good. So that just makes it really easy to deploy them to end users and to have it as more of a safe environment where if something happens, they're just kind of throwaway. Microsoft just released a version of this in the cloud where you can have a computer in the cloud that you just pay for. It's, you know, $20, $30 a month. And then if something happens to it, you just wipe it. It's not connected to your network at all other than through web traffic, which is pretty easy to monitor and regulate. Okay, so now we talked about a lot of the things that you guys can do to harden your networks and to segment your networks and turn on firewalls. So another thing you can do is to try to do what the attackers would actually do to see how you would hold up. We call these light penetration tests, but they are, because they don't really impact the system. It's more informational. So one thing that we often do are perform scans. Shodan and Nmap are two of the tools that we use a lot. Nmap is totally free. Shodan has a minimal cost. I believe Brittany said you guys have had Shodan demonstrations before, so I'm not going to get into that right now, but I'm happy to answer any questions about that later. Nmap is built into many Linux operating systems, and it scans your network and says these ports are open on these machines. So you can say, let's say you had a controller for a video signal controller, let's say, and that was listening to the world on port 80. An attacker would definitely find that and exploit that. So if you can find it first and then stop that, because you probably, I would imagine, don't want that, then you're ahead of the game. Another thing to do is to check your domain records. So if you look up, WIST.edu, it'll tell you who owns it and all that kind of thing. It usually lists real people. For WIST.edu, obviously it wouldn't, but for a lot of businesses, it does say, like, these are the technical contacts and these are those people. And then attackers can use that to try to go on LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever and try to figure out who that person is and what they do to craft phishing emails to that person. So if you, make that harder by using, the technical contact is tech@yourdomain.org and it's, Jimmy Tech, then that isn't useful. Or Jimmy Smith or, Bill Brown or whatever, just a generic name. And then an email has to be real so you can answer anything questions or whatever they might have about it. But if you just, hide that information as much as you can, it'll decrease the threat vector for you. And again, social media is a great place for attackers to go to see that this guy works with PHP and he works for this organization. Well, you just learned that a possible attack venue to get into that organization. So beware of that. So the next item is everybody's favorite, backups. If something does go wrong, it's great to have backups, although this is, I would say, the most neglected item on this list. Well, I guess it'd be a challenge, or it's probably a tie between people using passwords over and over again and not using backups. But I strongly recommend to have a backup and recovery system. A two-prong approach, one on site, one in the cloud or someplace else, off-site, another partner radio station maybe, or a TV station, whatever works for you. But always have multiples so you have more options if something goes wrong. But the biggest thing is to test and verify that it works, because a backup system that's running all the time that isn't actually doing anything is worse than having no backup at all. So we'll wrap it up here. This is a Hail Mary. Early on, when ransomware attacks started happening, it was noted that if you had a Russian keyboard installed on your machine, the software wouldn't run. This is because, well, at least, this is all speculation, and this could not work at any time. So that's why it's truly a Hail Mary. But the speculation was that most of these cyber gangs are in Russia, and as long as they don't attack Russian companies or Russian organizations, then Russia doesn't care what they do. Because big picture, most countries don't care if American companies are extorted for money. But they do care if those cyber gangs attack their own people, so that's why this works. You install this Russian keyboard, software goes to run. It checks that, because why would you have a Russian keyboard in the middle of Kansas or wherever else? You wouldn't. So then it's an easy check for the software to say, oh, this is someone we can't attack, so we won't, and then it doesn't work. But this is truly a Hail Mary. It is very small risk and small work, but I wouldn't only do this and hope for the best, because at any time, if this became common knowledge, the programmers could come up with a different way to get around this to check that the system was in Russia and shouldn't be attacked. But if all else fails, right, throw the Hail Mary and hope for the best. We don't have a ton ton of time left, but I'm happy to answer any questions. And you can feel free to reach out and email me as well. Oh.
All right, this is from one of the techs. Many of us need to access our transmitter sites over the internet. What are your thoughts on port forwarding or open ports to allow access to our transmitter controls?
Totally understand that. That is a common use case. I would say where possible, use a multi-factor VPN to try to protect that as opposed to just open ports. And the multi-factor is, I kind of glossed over that earlier on, but that is a big, that's currently, so everything right now is cat and mouse, right? The Russian keyboard, what we're doing, MFA, all of that stuff, it's cat and mouse. You know, give it enough time, it'll break down, and we'll have to come up with something else to prevent people from doing their thing. But right now, MFA is the big blocker that stops these attacks from happening. Used to be just having VPN was enough, but now we're starting to see more and more where the credentials, you know, attackers know enough that these credentials will work on the VPN, and then that'll get them better access to the network. So you need the MFA to make sure, like, oh, hey, I didn't actually log into my server at, you know, midnight, and so then it would be blocked by that. So, but I would say MFA with VPN would be the best way to go.
Yeah, piggybacking, we actually have one more question. How important is 2FA or MFA?
It is the best easy line of defense right now. I mean, don't get me wrong, it is not brainless to implement, and it is more overhead for all of your employees. But for that extra 30 seconds, you get a ton of protection, and it's just an extra hoop to jump through. One caveat I'll say with that, though, is make sure that your employees understand when they should hit that button. We've seen many situations where people just blindly hit yes or accept on their MFA tool, even if it wasn't them. So that you need to make clear to your employees or your coworkers or whoever that if you didn't log into something, hit no, and then change your password.
We've got two questions. First one, what about the efficacy of the commercially available and widely touted programs such as iDrive and Carbonite? Is that, are there any pitfalls to using those two? That's the first question.
So those are two online backup tools, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. There really isn't. Going back a couple slides, I did suggest offsite. That would be a great offsite backup option for you, depending on the cost. I would recommend checking into, it's Amazon Glacier, I wanna say. It's like a penny a gigabyte or something like that. It's very slow, but if it's offsite backup, hopefully you're only using it, you know, it's like a breaking, or in case of emergency, break the glass kind of thing. It's not, we need this right away. So hopefully you have on-site backups for that quick, you know, we need this now. And then you could use Amazon Glacier or whatever else for a slower, you know, a long-term backup strategy. But those are totally fine to use, but the same caveats that would apply, you know, make sure your user accounts that are actually logging into that system are not the same as the admin accounts that are provisioning the system.
Okay, the second question has to do with ports. What is to prevent us using anything above 1,000 as far as ports is concerned? Everybody seems to be stuck below 1,000. When you've got over 65,000 ports to deal with, you could stick your port forwarding into any one of those. I don't know how high the port number is that hackers look at in looking for their victims, but it would be very nice to be able to play cat and mouse using ports with them. Okay, do you understand the question? Because it's a little convoluted.
I do. So that is security by obscurity. I mean, you obviously can do that. The only thing, so getting back up a couple slides, Shodan, oh, there it is. Shodan runs all the time in the cloud. It's scanning everything all the time. So even if you move a port, it doesn't really matter. They're going to find it sooner or later. I mean, it's better than just, you know, having the default port set, but it's not really that secure. Like, it might buy you a little time potentially at best, but at worst, it's not really doing anything. It used to work in the past when computing power was expensive, but now you know, for $50, somebody can buy a Raspberry Pi 4. And just scan away all day long, every day, and it costs you $5 a year in electricity costs. So it's I wouldn't use that as the only thing you do, But it, as a strategy of defense in depth and doing other things, it's a viable option.
I'm glad you mentioned security through obscurity, because that was going to be my my next question, and that tends to be a pet peeve of mine for some reason, where you poke a hole, your firewall at your transmitter site starts looking like Swiss cheese as you poke holes to every device that you want to control. It's really not that difficult to set up a remote VPN on those devices or on those firewalls. Anyway, the second question that I had for you was talk a little bit about the balance between security versus convenience of, or ease of use of those security features. Because if you implement something that's really crazy, it may be the best standards in the world, but if it's really cumbersome for people to use or inconvenient for people to use, they're less likely to actually use it and more likely to find kind of workarounds to it. I'll give you a prime example. I know of a company recently that was about to roll out a password policy that was like 16 characters, must have a special character, must have uppercase and lowercase and a number, and the only way to get that is with a password manager, obviously, but a lot of people don't tend to use password managers for their personal passwords that they enter frequently at some sites, So can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, 2FA is great, especially if you've just got a simple way to confirm that, yes, this is you. Biometrics are even better as far as I'm concerned. That's probably the simplest way that you can actually implement this stuff. So, yeah, something you have and something that's unique to you. So can you talk about that convenience versus security?
Sure. So at the university, this is a constant struggle because it's really the wild, wild west. If a researcher doesn't like what we are offering for free or we're proposing, they can spend their money and do whatever they want to. So we have carrots and that's it. And I don't know about you guys. I love carrots. I eat them all the time. It's my go-to food. But turns out people don't like carrots that much. They like, sugar and other things. But so that's a constant struggle. The best analogy that I've ever heard for this is IT is trying to hold a balloon in your hands. If you squeeze too hard, the balloon is just going to pop out of your fingers. If you, don't hold it hard enough, the balloon is going to float away. So that is the balance that we're all trying to strike. And the example there, if you squeeze too hard, the balloon will pop through your fingers, and people will set up shadow IT, and they'll just use their own whatever it is. IT has become a commodity, and it's really easy to buy whatever you want for cheap, for minimal money. So if you guys set up a file share that's behind a VPN and people don't want to use that, they'll buy a Dropbox account and they'll just start using that. And then you'll have no idea that happens, as an example. So that is the balance that is a constant challenge to strike, the security of the system versus the ease of your client and customer use. I wish I had a good answer for that, but just always be cognizant of it. It never hurts to talk to your customers more before you implement something to try to understand what they actually need. And talking to people, lots of times they think their edge use cases are much more frequent than they are. I know a ton of people who have pickup trucks that never haul anything, don't tow anything. They just, want to spend a lot of money on gasoline, which is A-okay, but no one says, I really just want to spend a lot of money on gasoline, so I'm going to buy a pickup truck. They think, I'm going to go off-roading, I'm going to, go to Home Depot all the time, I'm going to get a boat, and then, they don't do those things. So that is, that's a human failing of everybody, right? How many projects have all of us taken on? We're like, I'm going to get right to that, and then it just sits in your basement, and then 5-10 years later, you just throw it away. That's a human problem that I wish I had an answer to, because I'd be very, very rich. But I don't. But just think about it and have that in the back of your mind, and try to just address it as much as you can when you're coming up with solutions to IT. Did that answer all your questions? For sure. And I will give another pitch to a password manager. It is, I would say, an hour or two to set it up. But once you get it set up, it is as brainless and easy as anything in the whole world. I have, 1,000 passwords to different devices. I know about 4 passwords, and it knows all the rest of them. I kind of like it to GPSs. When GPSs first came out, people were like, well, I know how to get around. I don't need a GPS. And there's a lot of pushback on them. But now everybody has a GPS and everything, and you just use the GPS, because why bother, you know, troubling your brain to figure out where's the traffic, what time of day is it, what's the fastest way to get to between A and B, when this computer can just tell you, hey, take this left, take that right, you're there, you avoided the traffic, and you're done. So I think there is an inertia behind not using it, but if you can get over that, it'll make your lives a lot easier.
Okay, a couple more texts. Assuming you have backups, how can you determine that they're not infected?
Good question. I would say the easiest way to do that is periodically, you know, maybe quarterly or biannually, semi-annually, however you like to say it, just randomly try to restore something and see if it's there, if it works, if the file is the same as the one that you backed up. That would be the easiest way to do it. The other thing I would recommend is, if possible, try to isolate that backup server or backup servers from everything else as much as possible, so then it has less options to get infected. Because that, again, that backup server, you don't need to print from it. It probably doesn't need to talk to the internet. You know, it just needs to be up and able to communicate to your servers on whatever port. So you could have it listening on whatever, but you could even block all the outbound traffic, or most of the outbound traffic, other than on certain channels.
Okay, then going off of that, how important are software updates and patches in general?
Well, I mean, all of this stuff is critical when it fails. The real answer for all this stuff is it depends, too. Just last week, all the bad news that we just get bad news these days, there was a zero-day bug for Confluence, which Confluence is a Wikipedia-like software that a lot of companies use. There was a zero-day bug that got a lot of companies infected, you know, without really any notice or any ability to patch it before it was being attacked. So it is critical to run those monthly patches, but generally speaking, you have more time than not. Oftentimes we find, you know, 3 or 4 year old exploits that are still, you know, haven't been patched, and that's what people get hit on. It's generally speaking not the zero day variety, although as I say that, I think about this year, and there was an Exchange server zero day that was very actively exploited. There was this Confluence zero day that was very actively exploited. So it's very important, and it unfortunately seems to be more important than it used to be. I know, so I haven't talked about any customer, you know, solutions for this, but having an asset inventory and knowing what you have and what it is running is a really critical piece of this that I didn't really talk about, just because it's a topic all to itself, and I could talk about that for an hour. But we use a tool called Qualys internally at the UW that tells us what the machines are, what software they're running, what ones are out of date, and it'll generate reports for us on whatever cadence we want to notify us, you know, hey, Susie's machine hasn't phoned in 2 days, and when it last did phone in, it was running, you know, Adobe from 2015, so you probably want to fix that, or, you know, that kind of thing. So there are a lot of software out there that do that kind of thing, and I would recommend setting up a system like that, because it is a lot easier than just knowing, I've got these 80 servers, these 20 are running, you know, Windows 2012, and, you know, they're out of date. But the other thing you can do is just try to document, you know, the Patch Tuesday is Microsoft's thing, right? So as long as you're patching the second week of every month for all your Windows systems, you're probably gonna be okay, because there are a lot of companies that don't do that. It was a very long-winded answer to that. Hopefully I got the question.
I have two questions, actually. The first is, when designing IPsec site-to-site tunnels that are gonna be nailed up forever, what currently is the recommended best practice for the algorithm choice, for the encryption algorithm? Because I know some of them are no good anymore.
Correct. That's a moving target as well. So I don't know exactly what options you have, but 256-bit encryption would be So AES 256 is what I would recommend if that is an option. But basically the more bits, the better. There is a lot of talk in the cybersecurity community that once quantum computing becomes available, that none of this will matter anyway and everything will just be open. But we're not there yet. Hopefully it's something like AI. You know, AI has been right around the corner for 50 years. It's still right around the corner. So just keep holding your breath, guys. We're going to have AI take care of everything really soon. So hopefully quantum computing is the same thing. But yeah, 256, you know, choosing the highest levels you can will never treat you wrong.
Okay. Second question, you mentioned this, but I'd like to get a better clarification on, say, Dropbox or other cloud-based storage mediums that are, say, protected two-factor. Are they secure? I mean, can you use them? What is the drawback?
This is actually the primary thing that I do at the university is dig into this kind of software as a solution or different companies for how reliable they are. Unfortunately, there isn't really an easy answer to this question. You need to look at the terms of service, look at the privacy policy, that kind of thing. Try to think about what, you know, how much do you care about what you're putting into the system versus those things. So for example, if you encrypted all of your data first before you sent it up there, it's pretty safe. And I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't be downloaded and cracked, but it's a lot more work than if you just, you know, uploaded all your tax files unencrypted. That's easy to grab and then do something with. Those are the things I would look at is, you know, look at the terms of service for the site, try to find web reviews and see what people are saying about it. There's a great company called Citizen Labs out of Canada that they do very deep reviews of different software. They were the first one to call Zoom out for over-promising and under-delivering on their product when Zoom first became big. Zoom has since fixed those issues, but Citizen Lab discovered those. I mean, it wasn't anything else that that caused that to happen. Google's your friend to check that stuff out. But just try to think about how much you care about something or the value of that data that you're putting up there, and then what you're doing to protect it to begin with. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, one more from the text. I think that probably might be our last one, I'm not sure, but depending on how long the answer is. Can you talk about securing purpose-specific broadcast equipment? For example, AOIP hardware, remote control, specialized systems that may run on Windows but aren't general purpose servers or workstations.
Unfortunately, I cannot. I play a cybersecurity professional, but I don't know anything about what you guys do, other than I respect the heck out of it, and it's amazing all the things you do, but I don't know specifically about that kind of stuff. I will say that containers and Docker and, you know, that kind of thing is a great option, but again, that's a whole, you know, that's a 10-week, you know, educational course to get into that kind of thing. But just in general, trying to pare back what a system does, think about it. Like a Swiss Army knife is great if you absolutely need one and you don't have anything else. But, you know, I'd rather have a butcher's knife. I'd rather have an actual can opener. I'd rather have an actual wine bottle opener. You know, I mean, it's better than nothing, but it's also awful at everything compared to a dedicated tool. So trying to do that in IT is another best practice, is have, you know, your print server only be a print server. Have your, I don't even remember the acronyms that you just dropped, but, you know, have a machine only be that machine. So then, you know, it's easier to also see the metrics on it. So if your broadcast server is always running at 20% CPU, it's easy to say, if it spikes up to 100%, it's easy to say like, hey, something's wrong here. But if you have all of a bunch of different services running on a single machine, it's much harder to say what's going on there because it's not a single, you know, single dedicated use machine. So it's kind of a bad answer, but that's what I got, sorry.
Hello, back over here. So you've been kind of focusing a little bit more on what the business case would be because we live in a Windows world and, you know, the exchange bugs and the zero-day exploits. In our world, just to educate you, a lot of broadcast devices are appliance-based. So it's a box that you buy from a vendor that runs either Linux, 90% it's an embedded OS, or a highly modified version of Windows. But the recourse from our end, for instance, I had satellite receivers that were taken over in a DDoS attack. I have zero control over that machine. Yeah, I have to go back to a vendor. Do you have an approach to a vendor in that situation from a cybersecurity standpoint on rectifying that? Because we can't. They're like, what do you know?
I'm sorry to hear that you guys have vendors like that. That is not the kind of vendor I'd want to work with. Sorry, what was that?
And sometimes those vendors have no idea how to answer the question either.
That I've encountered plenty where, a vendor is just like, well, we'll take your money and we'll figure it out, which that unfortunately is a common situation. So I guess I would say try to get, ounce of prevention. Before you get one of these boxes, try to see if they have a best practices document or any kind of like, this is how I would set it up. These are the ports I would leave it open. This is what it absolutely needs to work, and then stop everything else from talking to it or reaching it or, another thing I would say is try to, again, segment that off. You know, if anything you don't trust, like these appliances I wouldn't trust, try to put them by themselves. So if something happens to them, they can't infect the rest of your systems.
The perfect example is like the satellite receivers that Wisconsin Public Radio uses are a Linux box. Part of their failover mechanism is public IP. So they will call out to the NOC at their site to pull down audio or live stream and stuff like that should the satellite fail, or they can run full time in that instance. So walling them off is usually not an option. So this is a known risk in this world. But they have to also talk into the internal systems that are pretty much, don't touch, no one touches this. So it's very, that balance that Shane was discussing of usability versus functionality.
Oh, for sure. And I don't mean to completely wall it off, but just, make sure that anything that it communicates with is known and intentional. So don't just give it the full access to your network. If it talks to your backend server on port 8080, only give it access to port 8080. Don't give it access to the whole system. Another common security concept is least privilege. So, give this the very least amount of privilege it can do to do its job, and then you will reduce the likelihood and the impact if something happens to it. But that is a tough situation, unfortunately. It's a lot easier at home because, like I said, my thermostat, if it goes down, whatever, I can unplug it, I can plug it back in, I can put the old thermostat back in there, it's not the end of the world, but I don't use my thermostat to broadcast television across the world. So, but again, the same principles do apply. It's just a more complex and harder problem for you guys to solve. Again, life really is pretty easy. It's just the executing on life is where we fall down. So, well, thanks everyone. Hopefully this was useful for you, and good luck. Hopefully the ransomware attackers will never get you. They'll get other people, not you guys.